Hello, and welcome to the Global Law at Reading podcast, the GLAR podcast. I'm your host, James Green. This podcast features a presentation by Dr. Miles Jackson, who's a member of staff at the University of Oxford. And that presentation took place on Wednesday, the 30th of November, 2016. It was chaired by my colleague, Dr. Ruvi Ziegler, and it was the second in the 2016-17 programme of Gandhi Research Seminars under the Global Law at Reading banner. Dr. Jackson's presentation was entitled Early Release at the International Criminal Court. And I wanted to also say that at the request of the speaker, the Q&A session from the presentation hasn't been included in this podcast. I hope you enjoy it.
Okay, welcome everyone. Good afternoon. To this second installment of the GLAR series for this academic year. The talk itself will be recorded for a podcast, but the Q&A afterwards won't be, so you can say anything that is within the legal remit in UK criminal law at that stage. It gives me really great pleasure to introduce Dr. Miles Jackson, who I've known for several years back. Miles is now departmental lecturer at the Faculty of Law in Oxford. He's the stipendiary lecturer at St. Peter's. And he works generally in the areas of international criminal law, general international law, and domestic criminal law. He's just had a book last year on complicity in international law, which looks at ICL and state responsibility. And he has a DPhil, MA from Oxford, LLM from Harvard, and he previously was a Global Justice Research Fellow at St. Anne's College in Oxford and the convener there of the Transitional Justice Research Group. And he also clerked at the Constitutional Court of South Africa and the ICJ. So quite a breadth of experience, and we're going to hear from Miles. He asked for a snappier title to be used, so we're going to hear about early release under the Rome Statute, and he'll talk for about 25, 30 minutes, and then we'll have plenty of time to discuss. Thanks.
Thank you, Ruvi, and thanks everyone for coming. I'm delighted to be here. So let me start with two caveats, with the pre-caveat that whenever my students talk with caveats, I tell them to just make their point, but I need to make two caveats. First, I hope everyone has a handout, and if you turn it over, you'll see you have some provisions, which are upside down, which is indicative of my tech ability. And second, in a way, this paper is a work in progress, but in a work in progress in a particular way, which is that I'm still not sure that it's whether it's one paper or two papers, and I hope we'll see that the two difficulties that I identify with the enforcement regime under the Rome Statute might need to be treated differently. So in a way, that's my initial caveat. So let me say something about the average war criminal, and amongst other things, the average war criminal has two distinguishing features, at least compared to ordinary domestic criminals. One is that they are generally older, and the second is that they are generally embedded in political struggle or political conflict. This might not be true across the board, but we know that Karadzic is in his 70s and Charles Taylor's in his 60s and Goring was in his 50s. So what we have is a sentencing regime set up by the International Criminal Court that will, in the ordinary case, sentence older figures embedded in political struggle. So what I'm interested in is the implications of those two points for the enforcement regime that has been set up by the Rome Statute. Let me just say something in brief or structural point about that enforcement regime. So it's consensual amongst state parties. State parties agree to be a member of a designated list of potential states of enforcement. After the sentencing and conviction of someone, they are the president of the court, the presidency, I should say, designates a state of enforcement, which subsequently signs a bilateral agreement, or previously signs a bilateral agreement with the court. So at the moment, I think there are 9 or 10 states that have agreed to be states of enforcement. Right now, we have more states of enforcement than post-trial detainees. So in a way, this is a problem of the future, and it's a problem that has been under-addressed because I think in general ICL scholarship has paid less attention to post-sentencing procedures for obvious reasons. So what we have after conviction of a figure, perhaps a leader at the ICC, is his or her transfer to a state where they are detained in accordance with that agreement with the court. So there's a bilateral state agreement between the state and the court. So what I'm interested in is early release. By early release, I mean obviously release before the end of the term, but also ordinary release. I mean, also early release before the specified statutory review procedure in the Rome Statute. So if you turn over the page and you have a look at Article 110.3, you will see a basic review mechanism. When a person has served two-thirds of the sentence or 25 years in the case of life, the court shall review the sentence to determine whether it should be released. The person should be released. So what we have is a mandatory review by the court. I'm just going to refer to it as the two-thirds cutoff, although it could be 25 years. So we have a mandatory review procedure that is set up in the Rome Statute. We have seen this, I think, in Katanga and Lubanga have undergone two-thirds procedures already. The orthodox position on Article 110 is that the 110.3 procedure is the only process in the statute for early release. So we have a mandatory procedure, but that any situation short of two-thirds of the sentence, or 25 years, entails no possibility of review by the court. So this is the orthodox position in the literature, and it's the orthodox position in the court's own understanding. So if you look at the rules of procedure, rules 223 and 224 set out more detailed, a detailed set of requirements, but they assume that 110.3 almost occupies the field. Let me just make a qualification. 110.5 is obviously an future iteration of the 110.3 procedure. So it happens after an ordinary 25-year or two-thirds release. So I'm not, in general, going to refer to 110.5. So we have an orthodox position that says any person detained by a state pursuant to conviction by the ICC cannot be released prior to the 25-year two-thirds cutoff. So I think there are two potential problems here, two quite different problems. The first is the problem of what I call compassionate release. By compassionate release, I mean a situation in which the individual circumstances of the detainee have shifted such that we can no longer justify their continued detention. So to start at the level of principle, there may be situations in which the justifying aims of punishment, in particular retribution and communication or communicative ideas, no longer make sense for this particular person. I'm thinking of infirmity or dementia. We've seen this in domestic cases. We've seen situations in which a person is no longer has sufficient agency to justify punishment of them. If we move beyond principle to practice, I do not know of a single state that doesn't have an exceptional release procedure for sick or elderly or mentally ill detainees. What that looks like, what that exceptional circumstance looks like in each state differs radically, but there's simply no mandatory, I've never found a mandatory position. In fact, I don't think there could be one because I think in general executives retain some discretion, even if it's not adjudicative. So as a matter of principle and practice, there's a problem here. And I think you can take this argument a step forward, which becomes important in the next section. To take this argument a step further, I think that the absence of an exceptional review procedure has the potential to violate international human rights law. I looked at the ECHR system, where there's been a lot of development, and we see cases where the court considers it's very, as it is in this context generally, review of domestic criminal procedures, it's reasonably cautious. But it's, for instance, in Moussel versus France, the court says, although the convention imposes no general obligation to release detainees on the basis of ill health, it cannot be ruled out that the detention of a person who is ill violates Article 3 of the convention, the prohibition on inhuman treatment. So as a matter of substantive rights application, there's a potential problem, which is that we can envisage a situation in which a detainee, the continued detention of a detainee, cannot be justified and potentially infringes or violates Article 3, which we find in other international instruments. I would take this a step further and rely on the Winter line of cases to say that once you have a substantive issue, the absence of a procedure to vindicate that right is itself a problem. So we need to have a mechanism for considering exceptional release if we can't preclude the idea that continued detention violates Article 3. So the first problem of compassionate release, I think, is a problem of principle and practice, but also of international human rights law, which I will return to. The second problem, which I'm perhaps more interested in, and is perhaps the more difficult case, is what I call political release. What I'm interested in here is prisoner release as a strategy of peacemaking. So I don't want to rehash the foundational debate in transitional justice, which is mechanisms of retributive justice versus peacemaking. For me, that argument has never been live. I have never been convinced that international law obligates prosecution at the expense of exceptional situations of amnesty. I'm happy to go into that legal claim. I think in the political scholarship, I don't think any legal scholar has ever answered Carlos Nino's 1991 account of Argentinian amnesty procedures as someone who was involved in drafting. As a political philosopher and constitutional lawyer, he responds to Diane Ehrenlicher's famous article in 1991 and says, you just don't know what it was like in Argentina at the time as a matter of political necessity. So to put that another way, to put it a little more legally, I would say in the first place, there are without doubt conflicting values that must be weighed up in a situation of conflict resolution. And potentially retributive justice values is one that might fall, at least in exceptional circumstances. Second, I think there's a local versus global issue here. Who has authority to make that plural balance? I think Nino's account is devastating for the universalist position about duties to prosecute. He says, we were there, and we were struggling, and if we had prosecuted the generals, we were done. That's on the strategy side, but I actually think it extends to the real plausible way up of values themselves. So in a way, I think that the legal ideas in which I support, the normative drift towards anti-impunity, all of these good things, which are great, runs up against political necessity as a matter of pragmatics, but also as a matter of principle. I don't really want to litigate that point because it's been litigated to death prior to conviction. So we see these debates about how the prosecutor might have discretion, the Security Council can defer a prosecution, interest of justice test. That's been absolutely covered. I think that international legal idealists would hold their line, and people who are actually working in situations would oppose it. I think Colombia offers a great example right now. So I think the international community's engagement with the amnesty was devastatingly bad. But we can come back to that. What I'm doing is talking about the same debate after conviction, which it re-arises. Imagine the FARC settlement with five or six senior leaders detained in Norway, post-conviction by the ICC. The only thing stopping the settlement as a matter of domestic legitimate, passed by referendum, is this prisoner release. We have an equality issue about international versus domestic. But in general, I think that the post-conviction, the idea that we might need some flexibility post-conviction is a strong claim there. So those are my two problems. We have compassionate release and political release, both of which are constrained by the orthodox interpretation of Article 110, which is that prior to two-thirds, there's no flexibility. So both of these problems, both of these issues are constrained by Article 110. So, as you will see, I'm trying to get at this in two different ways. One is a matter of pure treaty interpretation. So, what I propose is that the orthodox reading of Article 110.3, while plausible, is perhaps not the only interpretation, and I'll probably take it a step further and say not the better interpretation. Let me say a little about interpretation. So I'll be trying to use orthodox VCLT modes of treaty interpretation with the qualification that this is an international organization, so we must have due regard to its performance of its functions, as the ICJ has said, and WHO, and in other cases. The effective performance of its functions is probably what will drive it. But let me start with text. So I'm interested to see, I've stared at this provision for hours, and I may be reading things that are not in it. So this is my proposal.
It's possible to do if you're reading it upside down.
That's right. So, as I said, the author's interpretation is Article 110.3 is the only mechanism under this provision. My big problem is the underlined text. No, such a review shall not be conducted by this time. So my argument is that Article 110.2 establishes what I would call a general power of the court to decide any reduction of sentence. So we can forget about Anshel rule on it for now. Any reduction of sentence, and then Article 110.3 is a sub part of that general right, but which is mandatory after 25 years. So I think a couple of textual and contextual elements support this reading. The first, which is probably the most important, is that, let me turn it back up so the right way. So if you look to Article 110.1, we see a requirement that the state of enforcement shall not release the person before the expiry of the sentence pronounced by the court. So this is the core organizing principle of the sentencing regime, international court's primacy. So we only have two actors here. We have, let's say, Denmark and the ICC, an obligation on Denmark not to release. We have in Article 110.3 clearly a duty to review, and with that duty, a power to release, of course. If that is true, then the first clause of Article 110.2 is redundant. It says the court alone shall have the right to decide any reduction of sentence. The temptation is to read alone as the key word in that sentence. So we could read that clause as saying, this court alone, so in other words, only this court can review. Whereas I think that the alone takes the focus off what is really a grant of a general right. The reason I think it's redundant is that if there are only two institutions in play here, Denmark and the court, and we know that the Denmark cannot release under Article 110.1, and we know that the court already has a power under 110.3, what does a clause that says the court alone shall have a right to decide any reduction do? So we have a pure text problem. I've played around with the idea that 110.2 establishes a right and 110.3 establishes a duty. There's potential inconsistency there. I think more interesting is the idea in 110.2 that the court can decide any reduction of sentence, any reduction of sentence. In the Trevaux, and I should say the Trevaux is neither clear in general for the statute or on this point, all the way through drafting, any reduction of sentence was formulated in a different way, which was parole, pardon, commutation. Parole, pardon, commutation. It shifted very late on to any reduction of sentence. And there is some material that suggests that was the shift without a thought that they were changing the sentencing modalities that we see in domestic law. My problem is, of course, then the such a review comes in later as an idea from a different drafting panel. So how I would read this text is to say, such a review shall not be conducted before this time, means that the mandatory review itself, which always happens, cannot be cannot take place before the 25 years. So such a review refers to only one of the modalities of the court's review, and then have a general power under 110.2. So if we think about text and context, I think it opens up at least the possibility of a second reading. If we think about object and purpose, or we bring in the idea of effective functional interpretation of a treaty instrument, it supports the reading that I suggest. The core principle under 110 is that the court has primacy in deciding decisions, in deciding issues of early release. And so as part of that core ambition, we must have an effective regime to deal with potential exceptional cases. If that's true, I would take it a step further. As you see on the back, we have rights consistent interpretation. There's a lot of debate around the actual meaning of Article 21.3 is applicable law. The application of interpretation of law must be consistent with internationally recognized human rights. I think Pelle's argument that this is some kind of supralegality is probably right. So, at least with respect to compassionate release, where we have a straight Article 3 issue, we can interpret 110.2 to confer general power. I'm interested in the argument that internationally recognized human rights is a broader formulation than international human rights law, which I could then deploy to protect my political settlement. If there's one thing we know about failures of political settlement, is that rights are violated. That's just a universal truth. But I'm not sure if I need to make the argument that, or if I want to make the argument that the 21.3 obligation of rights consistent interpretation supports my argument about political release. I think it may be stronger with respect to what I call compassionate release. So at the conclusion of five, I think at least some of the background work is done. The question is then, what does this mean? If 110.2 has a general power on the court to order release in exceptional circumstances of compassion or political necessity, how does this work in practice? The compassionate release part is straightforward. Courts in all domestic jurisdictions, or most domestic jurisdictions, are competent to deal with expert evidence to do with mental health or age or infirmity. So there would obviously be a degree of deference to expert decision makers, but we've seen that at the ICTY and we see it in domestic courts. So I don't think there's any particular problem with using 110.2 for the compassionate release part. For political release, there's a central problem, which is that that is not a decision that is a legal decision. A grant of exceptional prisoner release or amnesty post-conviction is simply one that this court, in fact, I would go further and say no court can make. So, there's related domestic constitutional reasons for that too, to do with separation of powers and accountability, but I just don't think the court can make a judgment as to whether the release of these six senior commanders is necessary for the peace talks in Colombia to succeed. So then my struggle becomes, how do we accommodate political decision-making within a legal, in an institutional legal framework that does not have an executive? And that's the potential second or longer-term project that I'm interested in. We have a court that does not have an ordinary executive power to deal with many of the things that we want executives to deal with. In domestic law, prisoner release is almost inevitably a political decision by executive decision makers. So what I've been thinking through is two ways to deal with this problem. Let me just reiterate that five senior FARC commanders are detained in Denmark. The court has no power to release them. Denmark has an obligation to the court not to release them, and yet it's a necessary part of a domestic political settlement. So I thought possibly we could have internal mechanisms of political decision-making to which the court would defer in an exercise of its 110(2) power, potentially Assembly of State Parties decision, potentially the constitution of a special panel which would inform the court's decision-making, or potentially deference to political organs of the United Nations, maybe Secretary General, who presumably will be involved in these exceptional cases. I haven't really thought through how the court can lawfully accommodate political necessities. In seven, you'll see I've said exceptional solutions, which I'm very excited about, just in general, because I can think of two reasonably straightforward, well, one reasonably straightforward and one less straightforward, exceptional political solution to this conundrum. The first is variation by the Security Council itself. So the Security Council will presumably be involved in the settlement talks, in the political, or the UN at least in some form, be involved in the talks. And I think we have a classic Chapter 7 determination that a whole set of measures are necessary for the maintenance of peace and security. And in that, the Security Council varies Denmark's obligation to the court. We know from Lockerbie, I think we know from Lockerbie, that this is plausible, permissible under the Charter. So what it would need is a specific resolution under Chapter 7 where the court, as part of its, and where the Security Council is part of a much more general resolution on the situation, perhaps the support for the domestic processes, varies that obligation, releases Denmark from its obligation to the ICC. So this is a reason for caution. I haven't fully thought through the implications of that view. The second is something which is perhaps even more exceptional, and that's the invocation of necessity in the law of state responsibility by Denmark. So it's something I've thought about in another piece, whether states are permitted to invoke necessity to protect essential interests of the international community or other states. So the commentary to the ILC's articles focuses on invocation of states of necessity for themselves, but or for the general interest of the international community. I don't think that's a difficult line to draw, to jump to make. I don't think it makes sense to refuse states the exceptional permission to invoke necessity to protect the interests of peace in another state. So what this looks like is Denmark breaching its obligation to the court under its bilateral agreement and to other state parties, invoking necessity under strict conditions, which we know, bearing the political burdens of doing so if states believe that it's not permissible. But this is a lawful solution to the problem of political release. So that's where I am on the paper. As I said, I have wondered if the compassionate release limb is a specific limb of a much more general problem and should be treated separately, and the political release should be treated in a separate paper, which raises what I'm interested in the longer term, which is the lack of political decision-making at the court. So I'd be very grateful for comments on all aspects of it. Thank you.